This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening.
You're on point five all the time, Tip. But then grab the microphone and let your words rip.
My words don't exactly rip like Q-Tip and the members of Tribe Called Quest, but we're all about the idea of tribes this hour on our radio program. Is tribe, for instance, the best word to describe the approach of the Republican Party right now?
If our generation of conservatives wants to enjoy our own defining triumph, our own 1980, we're going to have to deserve it. That means sharpening more pencils than knives. The kind of work it'll require is neither glamorous nor fun, and sometimes it isn't even noticed. But it is necessary. To deserve victory, conservatives have to do more than pick a fight. We have to win a debate.
That's Senator Mike Lee of Utah working on the Republican brand in a speech before the Heritage Foundation yesterday. We'll look at the tribal nature of American politics, first within the GOP, also how our mistrust of the other drives our national security policy and complicates it. We look at the shifting demographics in American cities and see why the Democratic tribe seems to be quite at home there, at least for now. But certainly us versus them was the theme on Capitol Hill today for Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, answering questions about the Affordable Care Act.
I apologize. I'm accountable to you for fixing these problems, and I'm committed to earning your confidence back by fixing the site.
Secretary Sebelius testified before the House Energy and Commerce Committee, where it's been good cop, bad cop all day long. Her first hearing before a congressional committee since the launch of ACA on October 1st. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, is with us. Hi, Todd.
Hi, John.
There's a couple of things here. First, there's Sebelius herself. This is really a test of her credibility. There are specific points that they're talking about in the hearings themselves, like people losing their insurance coverage, the so-called grandfather clause. And then, of course, there's the question of whether contractors completely botched the operation of the website. What stands out for you?
Well, one of the most interesting things is that this hearing, of course, was billed as oversight about the failed launch of healthcare.gov. Since last week's hearings on the failed launch of healthcare.gov, another sort of political cudgel for Republicans has come into play, which is the contradiction between President Obama's campaign statements, if you like your insurance plan, you can keep it, and the fact that for some enrollees who had non-grandfathered individual market coverage, well, that just hasn't been true. So the hearing's been about both of those things. What stands out the most here, John, really is the first time that Kathleen Sebelius gets to sort of punch back for an agency that's been taking a lot of punches. Contractors didn't punch back on behalf of HHS. In fact, they blamed HHS. The Margaret Tavener, who is the head of CMS, who testified yesterday, testified on largely technical grounds and really isn't in charge. It's Sebelius who Republicans have been waiting to sort of pinata here, and they've been doing it.
And CMS is the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight, and the head, Gary Cohen, is someone who's really been under fire. At one point, Dr. and Republican Congressman Burgess of Texas insisted that Sebelius fire Gary Cohen, and she looked straight at him and said, "No, I won't, Congressman." And here's another exchange along those same lines.
So who is responsible for overseeing this project? Is it you or your designee?
Let me be clear. I'm not pointing fingers at Verizon. I'm trying to explain the way the site operates. We own the site. The site has had serious problems.
At that team, who is the individual?
Michelle Snyder is the
Michelle CEO. Snyder is the one responsible for this debacle.
Excuse me, Congresswoman. Michelle Snyder is not responsible for the debacle. Hold me accountable for the debacle.
Okay.
I'm responsible.
Whose head? And of course, that's an exchange between Kathleen Sebelius and Tennessee Representative Marsha Blackburn, one of the Republicans, very, very critical here. Whose head does this committee want?
Well, ultimately, John, many of them want the head of Kathleen Sebelius, and several of them have called for her resignation on the Republican side. Several senators have as well. The president has expressed his confidence in Kathleen Sebelius, and others have called for resignation of people further down the list. You heard of Gary Cohen, who's the head of the Consumer Protection Insurance part of CMS. So Republicans are definitely looking for a scalp, if you want to call it that. They haven't gotten one yet.
You know this issue pretty darn well, Todd. Is firing and turnover going to actually make it more difficult for the site to run, or is it a kind of a SWAT team situation where maybe turnover is exactly what you need here?
Well, it probably wouldn't make too much difference at this point because the controversial role that CMS gave to itself, which was basically being the hub, the technical coordinator of all these different contractors, sort of the torso for all the different limbs, a lot of people say technically that was a mistake. Well, that function has been farmed out. It's been outsourced now to a private company that allegedly knows how to play that torso or that brain role. CMS at HHS is no longer doing it. So firing the head of CMS or Gary Cohn or anyone else at this point might be about accountability or political one-upsmanship. It probably wouldn't mean too much about the success or failure of healthcare.gov.
Tribes out for blood on Capitol Hill. Kathleen Sebelius testifying today on the Affordable Care Act. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You bet, John.
This is The Takeaway. Now let's look at a very different notion of tribalism in Washington, D.C. You got two groups. There's the National Security Establishment, that's the tribe with all the top secret security clearances, which includes some members of Congress, and then there's everybody else. In Congress, some of the toughest critics of the NSA and the CIA are members without security clearances. And the biggest supporters? Those members on the Select Intelligence Oversight Committees, like Congressman Mike Rogers of Michigan, here questioning NSA head Keith Alexander and National Intelligence Director James Clapper.
Do you believe that the allies have conducted or at any time any type of espionage activity against the United States of America, our intelligence services, our leaders, or otherwise?
Absolutely.
Spying among friends is not making our allies feel very warm and fuzzy toward the USA, with European leaders in Washington, D.C. demanding answers about electronic surveillance of foreign heads of state. The White House continues to review its policies regarding the folks on our side.
In the course of the review, some decisions have been made about our intelligence gathering activities, even as we proceed with it. And some of those decisions have been made and are being implemented.
It's White House Press Secretary Jay Carney defending the president and making the case that, in fact, all of the intelligence agencies of our European allies are guilty of this practice of mutual spying. Joining us now, Congressman Alan Grayson, Democrat from Florida's 9th Congressional District. Congressman Grayson, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Your view really here is that Congress and the oversight capacity in Congress, in the intelligence committees in the House and Senate, have really become captive of the tribe of the national security establishment and have ceased doing oversight on matters like spying on world leaders as well as the Snowden revelations. So do you actually believe that the House and Senate are in the pocket of the CIA?
Well, to a great degree, yes. I think you just heard an example of that, that little clip that you played regarding Mike Rogers questioning General Alexander. Mike Rogers is the person in the House of Representatives who's supposed to be in charge of oversight. There's been one scandal after another, including scandals indicating that General Alexander lied to Congress and the public. And yet I can guarantee you that that exchange that you just heard was a patty cake exchange where it was scripted out in advance with approval by General Alexander and his staff. So where's the oversight?
And how does this work? I mean, what would be an ideal situation in your view? Do you think Congress should have approval for every aspect of NSA surveillance?
Well, of course. I mean, that's our constitutional responsibility. And not only that, but given the gross abrogation of that responsibility that's led to all sorts of violations, pervasive violations of constitutional rights against virtually every American, I think that the system is completely broken. What we need is civil libertarians on these committees, not apologists for the spying industrial complex. And we also need a separate court. The FISA courts are utterly dysfunctional at this point. A separate court where the case is not only to be made in favor of spying, which is the situation now, but also to give the other side of the story.
Isn't this, though, a sign, and the Snowden revelations really, this is the emblem of it, that we've entered a fundamentally new age, that this technology changes the game so that our notions of civil liberties and the Fourth Amendment have to change along with them?
Not at all. I invite you to reread 1984, a novel that explained how you could establish pervasive domestic surveillance with technology from the 1940s. No, it's not a function of the technology at all. It's a function of our willingness to accept the idea that we don't have any privacy, we don't have any rights, even the ones prescribed by the Constitution. And that somehow, in some bizarre fashion, this is necessary in order to keep us safe.
Congressman Grayson, do you believe the Democratic president in the White House is captive of the National Security Agency and the CIA establishment, as you call it? He claims that he didn't know about a lot of the activities that have come to light in the Snowden revelations, including the spying on world leaders.
Well, I hope he's not a captive. But in fact, when some of these revelations did come out, the president became part of the apologist corps. I say this knowing well, full well, that he's the leader of my party, that I voted for him twice, and that I have a substantial amount of admiration for him. But when we first learned about the Snowden revelations, the president's reaction was to poo-poo it.
Are you closer to Rand Paul, the Republican senator from Kentucky, on this issue than you are with, Harry Reid, the leader in the Senate in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think Harry Reid's position is neutral and open-minded. I think that Rand Paul's position is principled and constitutionally based. And he's not the only one who feels that way. If you look at the vote on the Amash Conyers Amendment, which would have eliminated this ridiculous program that requires a report to the Department of Defense and the NSA every time that you and I make a phone call, including this one. We tried to eliminate that program through Amash Conyers Amendment, and we had roughly as many Republicans voting for that, including people of principle like Justin Amash, like Rand Paul, as we did Democrats.
Finally, do you believe that the Snowden revelations suggest that someone like Snowden, who works for a subcontractor, has more standing in knowledge of national security than you, a sitting congressperson?
Well, it's turning out that way, and that's truly bizarre when you consider the fact that every member of Congress automatically has classified security clearance, and nevertheless we're kept completely in the dark. The only people who even purport to know about these programs are the 20 people out of the 435 of us who sit on the intelligence committees. And frankly, I think their information has been very spotty.
Congressman Alan Grayson, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Congressman Alan Grayson is a Democrat representing Florida's 9th congressional district. On the day before Halloween, we're sharing scary stories. Tell us one from your childhood.
This is Claudia from Hollywood, Florida. The scary story from my childhood that I remember every Halloween is The Golden Arm from the Great Ghost Stories album back in the early 70s. It's a story of a woman named Elvira whose gold arm was stolen from the grave and who goes looking for it ever after. That story scared the pants off me and my brother every year.
Thanks, Claudia. From Bethesda, Maryland, my sister told me spiders crawl into my open mouth in my sleep and would build webs across my throat so I would suffocate and die. Nice, sister. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Tell us your spooky tale.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's worth remembering, folks, that before Senator Ted Cruz became something like the Darth Vader of Republican politics, he was a champion of the GOP breaking free of its traditional constituency and going after that famous 47% that presidential candidate Mitt Romney talked about during the 2012 campaign. Cruz said almost a year ago on The Takeaway that people who depend on government, in fact, in his view, are a natural for the GOP.
And in my view, Republicans, every day, we should champion the 47%, those climbing the economic ladder, because it is reaching the American dream. It is the opportunity to do so that has made America strong.
But in reality, can Republicans really champion the 47%? Here's a stat. On a list of the U.S.'s largest cities, you have to go down to number 13, Indianapolis, before you find the first Republican mayor. Most mayors in the United States, overwhelmingly, are Democrat. Republican Mayor Scott Smith of Mesa, Arizona joins us now. He's president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Mayor Smith, welcome.
Hello.
What do you make of that statistic? You got some work to do there in the city halls of America.
Well, Republicans do have some work to do because I think on a national level, the organization, even at the state level, Republicans have forgotten cities. They, whether they've written them off or whether that is the changing demographics and the urbanization of America has hurt Republicans, I don't know. All I know is that as a Republican mayor of a fairly large city, Mesa is the 38th largest city, we often feel sort of alone as Republican mayors.
Interesting. Also with us is Sarah Bird Sharps, who's co-director of Measure of America. Welcome, Sarah.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
What are the numbers in American cities that really tell the tale of why the Democrats seem to have this constituency sort of locked up?
Well, first of all, just to look at what's happened in cities recently, cities in the U.S. are thriving and growing. They're actually growing faster than the suburbs for the first time in about 90 years, which is an incredible statistic. They're also becoming younger. They have less crime than they have for 20 years. And more than half of America's cities are now majority non-white. So that's an important statistic as well.
And it would seem, according to Ted Cruz, that, you know, these folks climbing the economic ladder would be a natural constituency of the GOP. Mayor Smith, why hasn't that message been articulated since the 2012 election?
Well, I think when you look at a Republican mayor, and whether it's in a central city or a suburb, and in many metro areas, that distinction has become more and more blurred because we're more metro areas, megapolitan areas, than we are within there is a very stark divide between the central city and the suburbs. I think Republicans don't really go to their strengths. Republican mayors in large metro areas do well. They govern in a way that has a message that does appeal to the broad-based political spectrum. It's just that the party seems to have a different message than oftentimes the Republican mayors govern from. Same principles, but the emphasis is different very often.
And here in New York City, two Republican mayors, Michael Bloomberg and preceded by Rudy Giuliani, really changed the way in which mayoral politics was conducted here, but we're about to go back probably to a Democratic mayor here in New York City. Is this a moving target, Sarah Bird Sharps, in the sense that there are changes going on in the cities that could make this more of an opportunity for the right-messaged Republican, say, a Chris Christie?
I think the thing that we don't talk enough about is that we in urban areas live in a pretty crowded life, right? So people living in urban areas are more likely to see a role for and welcome a government that's taking care of things like collecting our garbage, even making the subways and the trains run on time, even making sure our elevators are inspected, right? So that there's no our cranes are inspected so that there's no damage. And so a party that is talking about those public services that we depend on every day is more likely to resonate, I think, with people than a party that's talking about cutting those services.
And the Reagan message was run against Washington, and we've really heard that from both parties to a certain extent, but certainly from the Republicans since the 1980s. Was Ronald Reagan wrong, Mayor Scott Smith?
Well, in the 1980s, I don't think he was, and even today, I don't think he was. But the obsession with running only against Washington, I think, has hurt Republicans because, I think one of the secrets that Democrats have found is they have mayors who actually govern like Republicans. There used to be a very stark divide between the messages. Republicans were very tough on crime, efficient government, limited government. And you see that Democratic mayors really govern using that mantra. They govern using those same principles because that's smart government. And when they are governing, like we've seen in many large cities, taking plays out of the Republican playbook, it's awfully hard for Republicans to overcome this obsession with Washington and the social issues.
And on the downside, Democrats sometimes run into trouble because they're in a machine city where Democrats essentially rule and they can run afoul of patronage and there's less accountability for Democratic mayors in certain cities. Do you find in places like Chicago and New York to a certain extent and other cities around the country that having a kind of one-party system can be trouble for the mayors as well as an asset politically?
It isn't proven that way so far in a lot of the bigger cities. We've seen New York after 20 years of basically Republican rule is going back to Democratic, and the election doesn't appear to be even close. What you also find, though, is that many Democratic mayors are, because the way that they're governing, especially through this recession, are really in conflict with many of their natural constituencies. You see Democratic mayors going head-to-head with unions because of the financial realities, and you see them stepping up. So it's not only the changing demographics, but it's the way that Democratic mayors have been governing which really mirrors what a lot of Republican mayors have done. And Republicans just need to do a better job of saying, listen, we can do this better. We have a way of governing that really resonates with cities. And for the reasons that Sarah talked about, the collective nature that cities have, that we have to work as a group. Sometimes is it at odds with the national anti-Washington Republican message, but it really resonates with the core principles of the Republican Party. That's just a message that Republicans aren't good at getting out.
And I think it really does have to do with specific issues. You know, young people today have choices of where they're going to live. And for cities to compete, to get sort of the best and the brightest, they need to offer the kind of things that attract, you know, today's globalized knowledge workers. Things like good schools, efficient transportation, affordable childcare, places to build community. All those things are critical to you know, really having a thriving city and to being the city that, you know, that knowledge workers want to locate in. And those issues are issues that fall along party lines often.
And if special interests in cities don't complicate matters, those services really produce a natural constituency for whoever manages to deliver them, Republican or Democrat. Sarah Bird Sharps, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Bird Sharps is co-director of Measure of America, a nonpartisan social science research council. And Mayor Scott Smith, thanks to you.
Thank you, John.
Mayor Smith is the Republican mayor of Mesa, Arizona, and president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Emotional prisoner release by Israel was greeted with celebration by Palestinians today, trepidation by Israelis. This is a difficult decision we have made with a heavy heart, says Israel's defense minister Moshe Yaalon. 26 Palestinian prisoners today held by Israel for years received hero's welcomes in the West Bank and Gaza. In total, 104 prisoners are due to be released as part of a deal brokered by Secretary of State John Kerry. Joining us now is Deanna Butu, a Palestinian human rights attorney. She joins us from Ramallah in the West Bank. Deanna, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So I gather you support this prisoner release. Is a hero's welcome an appropriate response to this release, do you think?
Absolutely. These are people who have been languishing in prison now. Many of them were supposed to have been released 20 years ago. Some of them were supposed to have been released 14 years ago. And the fact that they've been held up for all of these years, the fact they haven't been released, simply demonstrates the fact that the Palestinians continue to hold firm and continue to hold fast and continue to demand the rights and demand that they be treated as equals.
What about the expression of goodwill by the Israelis here that this prisoner release at least may represent? Does it give momentum to possible talks to get peace discussions going?
I don't think so. You know, I think it's important to put this in perspective. Right now, there are over 5,000 additional Palestinians who are in Israeli prisons, including over 130 of them who are being held without charge and without trial in what is called administrative detention. If the Israelis really want to demonstrate that they're serious about moving forward, then they would be releasing these people. They would be stopping settlement construction. They would be sending all of the signals to demonstrate that they don't just want to keep Palestinians in prison, but the Palestinian society as a whole under Israeli military rule and under Israeli prison. So while the 26th, it's important that these people are being released. Unfortunately, it's coming at a very, very, very late stage in the game.
But Deanna Butu, it does appear that on both sides, there's just limited interest in doing anything that's going to be a breakthrough here. And I think that's frustrating for anyone, John Kerry included, who might want to broker things.
I agree, John. And I think that if we are really serious, and if Secretary Kerry is very serious about pushing peace and wanting peace, then he will know very well that the time is now to put an end to Israel's settlement activity, scale back the settlements completely, and to give the Palestinians the dignity, the respect, and the freedom that they deserve.
Couldn't you make that argument, though, to Palestinian leaders as well, that with unrest in Egypt and the war going on in Syria, that there's really an opportunity and an urgency to try and resolve this independent of the international community?
I don't think that that's possible. I think that what's going on regionally actually does send the signal that it's very important, very pressing, that this occupation end completely. I mean, this is a reason to move forward and to end the occupation, not a reason to continue the occupation. So I think, if anything, what's going around on around the region should be prompting the Israelis to say, you know what, it's time that we actually end this military rule. It's time that we let the Palestinians live in the freedom that they deserve, because otherwise this is going to continue to have a spillover effect in all of the countries in the Middle East.
A release of 26 prisoners, an emotional step, but a small step in the view of Diana Bhutu, Palestinian human rights attorney, speaking to us from Ramallah. Diana, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, anticipating political heat over the prisoner deal, called it one of the toughest decisions he's ever made as prime minister. Quote, "This decision is a necessity given the reality in which we live." Meanwhile, the political rhetoric from the conservative Jewish Home Party is far from conciliatory. Releasing terrorists is immoral, weakens Israel, and endangers Israeli citizens. That group had tried to block the Kerry prisoner release deal in the Knesset, but failed. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Our fear of the unknown is both real and, in this week of Halloween, irresistible.
This is Mike from Salt Lake City. One Halloween, my friends and I walked up to a house with a bowl of candy that said, "Take one." We couldn't resist and grabbed the entire bowl. As we did, the scary-looking fake monster sitting there stood up and screamed. We dropped the bowl, leaving with no candy.
You got a scary story? Halloween or not? Legendary fiction writer, author of kids' book series like Goosebumps, Fear Street, and Nightmare Room, R.L. Stine has a good story about trick-or-treating with his little brother Bill in Ohio as a young boy.
I think I was about 12, and Bill must have been 9, I guess. Mm-hmm. And we went out trick-or-treating. It was the first year we were allowed to go out trick-or-treating by ourselves, no parents. And we went out as ghosts. We had sheets, and we took big shopping bags for all the candy we were going to collect. And I took a can of, you know, that silly string, that stuff you, just in case we had to string somebody. And we went out. It was a cold October night, and we always started trick-or-treating at Mrs. Dawson's house across the street. But I looked over, and her house was dark. I said, "Bill, she isn't home. We'll have to start somewhere else." We went up for blocks, collecting candy, trick-or-treating. Blocks came back. Our bags were bulging with candy. We were really happy. I looked across the street. There was a light on in Mrs. Dawson's front window. I said, "Oh, I guess she's home. Let's go over there." As we got closer, I saw it wasn't a light in the window. It was a big jack-o'-lantern, a fiery yellow jack-o'-lantern with a huge grin carved on its face. And we went up to her front porch and knocked on the door. She didn't come. I rang the bell, knocked on the door. She didn't come. Bill said, "She's in there, Bob. Go ahead, string her." So I took the can of silly string, and I raised it to her door, and I was about to push the button on it, and then I stopped because I was looking at the jack-o'-lantern in the front window, and it wasn't yellow anymore. It was this bright, fiery red, and it wasn't smiling. It had this horrible, ugly scowl on its face. And I dropped the can of silly string, and Bill and I started running down the driveway. We just started running away. And we were halfway down the driveway when the front door came open, and Mrs. Dawson came out. I remember she was wearing this long gray nightgown. I remember the nightgown fluttering in the wind. And she said, "Why did you wake me? Why did you wake me?" And I said, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Dawson. We didn't know. I'm really sorry. But could you answer a question?" She said, "What? What is it?" I said, "That jack-o'-lantern in your window. How did you do that? How did you make a change?" And she said, "Jack-o'-lantern? I don't have a jack-o'-lantern." And Bill and I looked in the front window. It was completely dark. So we ran across the street. We ran home. We went up to our room. We poured out all the candy. We divided it up. We never said another word about it. Not another word. But the next morning, I got up and I thought I really should go apologize to Mrs. Dawson for waking her up last night. So I got dressed for school, I had breakfast, and I went outside, crossed the street, and there was a big truck in Mrs. Dawson's driveway and these workers moving in and out. And I went up to one of the workers and I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Oh, I guess you're getting new neighbors, kid." I said, "Why? What do you mean?" He said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Didn't you hear? Mrs. Dawson died last week."
Get out.
That's my true ghost story.
Get out of here.
Do you think maybe I made up part of it?
What do you think? Some scary fiction there from author R.L. Stein, or a real-life ghost story? We'll have more with R.L. Stein, author of Goosebumps and many other kids' books, tomorrow on The Takeaway. We always want to hear from you. If you have a scary Halloween story, share it with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. Now playing.
Last night, my 12-year-old son was mixing up a batch of fake blood for his zombie Justin Bieber costume. Hey, all his idea. But the notion that blood fascinates us, inflames us, defines us is a very old one, of course, and central to our notions of self and tribe. Novelist Lawrence Hill takes a deep dive under the skin to explore our myths about the stuff of life that courses through our arteries and veins. Blood, the Stuff of Life, is his book, and it begins with the gory story of a little kid seeing his own blood for the very first time.
One time I cut my wrist playing as a child in a schoolyard and ran up the street intentionally bleeding on every sidewalk panel for the 200 yards between the site of the accident and my mother's house, because even though I was terrified and losing lots of blood, I wanted to make sure that I marked every sidewalk panel with an unbroken string of blood. Why would an 8-year-old think to do such a thing? I think it's because I sensed deep inside that this was something sacred and special spilling out of me, and I should therefore use it to mark the occasion. Who wants to waste their own blood?
And then you had a much more serious encounter with a glass window pane that caused you to actually see inside of yourself. Part of the story here in this book is just how much blood reveals, but also how little blood reveals of what we think it is. Our mythology is great when it comes to blood.
It sure is. And really, there's no other bodily part or fluid or substance that sort of seduces us and holds us in this thrall the way blood does. We don't spend hours or centuries fixating on our saliva or on our livers, but blood is something really, really special to us, and blood is the one part of us that feeds into our own sense of identity. I think in a way, in the West, it dates back to thousands of years of thinking about the body being divided into four humors, you know, black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood, and the idea is that personality can be ascribed to the balance between these humors in the body, and this really dominated human thinking in the West for thousands of years.
In the history that you describe here, and it is really fascinating because our notion of the way blood is today doesn't even begin to resemble what it was hundreds of years ago, and we grasped onto blood as humans in the beginning because it seemed so simple.
It sure isn't simple. And the ideas we've had, like that one of the very first transfusions on record, or attempted transfusions, is a French physician who grabs a psychotic man off the streets of Paris in 1667 and forcibly transfuses into this psychotic man the blood of a calf, because the physician believes that the tranquil essence of the calf's personality will somehow enter the veins of this patient and rid him of his problems. Well, it rids him of his problems, all right. It rids him of his life and kills him, because, of course, you can't take an animal's blood in your veins. So these things aren't simple at all. Even the issue of transfusion took a long time before we really came to understand, finally, around 1901, that what matters is you match blood types in order to have a safe transfusion from human to human. But as blood moves from a bodily substance, a medical and scientific property, to one of metaphor and personality, it becomes more and more complex.
The story of race is in our understanding of blood. The story of gender is in our understanding of blood. Why, and how did you sort of rediscover that in the investigations for this book?
Well, it's really incredible to think of blood as a divider between men and women. And I would say that for thousands of years, men have come to imagine blood to be a trophy of sport or war, or perhaps a byproduct of accident, if, say, somebody hurt or shot or stabs you. But for women, of course, if they're of childbearing age, blood is a sign of their fertility, is a sign of their health. They should be bleeding monthly unless they're pregnant. And so blood is something that a woman's going to encounter on a monthly basis. And I think men and women have profoundly different responses to it. And men for thousands of years have misinterpreted in spectacular ways women's blood and women's bleeding. And I think this has led in many ways to many of the ways in which women have suffered discrimination on the job, you know, in the military, etc. So blood and gender is huge. But blood and race is also huge. And nowhere is this more extreme than in North America, where we have this idea that you can boil down a person's race to blood parts, and laws and court decisions are made based on trying to find numbers to attribute race to blood parts in Canada and in the United States. It's a process that is in some ways ongoing.
I'm wondering, as a dad of five kids, you and I share that, what do you think when you see the blood of your own kids in the course of their growing up?
I have five children, and my wife and I married, and I brought three children from a previous marriage into the equation, and Miranda brought two children from her previous marriage into our new house. And my father was an African American, and my mother was a white American who moved to Canada. My wife is white, and her daughter Beatrice is white. And one day, when Beatrice was about five, she spoke to my wife. She'd been in my life already for two or so years, and she said, "Well, Mummy, I'm a little bit black too, right?" And Miranda said, "Well, what do you mean, Beatrice?" And Beatrice said, "Well, Larry's black, and he's my stepfather, so that makes me a little bit black too." And this put my wife in a very interesting and delicate position of trying to explain to Beatrice that, you know, race isn't generally seen that way, and one generally imagines that race derives from biological or family ancestry. But really, who's to say that Beatrice couldn't acquire a different identity? Thousands of people have changed their identity, perhaps people who convert to Judaism, perhaps people who slide in passing from calling themselves black to calling themselves white. There are all sorts of people who've played with and toyed with their own identities, even permanently. Why should Beatrice be denied the idea of thinking of herself as black if she wants to? And it was a very touching and interesting encounter with a five-year-old, and it really cast us back to notions of blood and identity, and we had to think through it to talk to her.
And it's the blood that keeps our mind going and
it sure is.
Allows us to have this license, but the blood doesn't care. It's just keeping us alive.
The blood doesn't care, but we do.
Lawrence Hill, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Lawrence Hill is the author of Blood, the Stuff of Life. And as we celebrate Halloween this week, we're asking you to share your spooky tales, things that scared you as a kid and continue to haunt you today. From Pleasanton, California, "When I was a young child," you write, "I would run to the door and greet my father every night after he would come home from work. One stormy Halloween, he rang the doorbell, and when I went outside to greet him, he jumped out from behind his car in a werewolf mask. Now, every Halloween, I'm a little more careful when I open doors." Tell us your scary story. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Sit back, relax, and let yourself go. Don't sweat what you heard, but act like you know. Yes, yes, y'all.
Yes, y'all.
Who got the vibe? It's the tribe, y'all.
Tribe, y'all.
Vibe, y'all.
Vibe, y'all.
Inside, outside.
Our final thoughts in this hour-long quest to understand the nature of tribes in our time. We have a scientific look at what it is that makes us humans separate the us from the them, and how we organize our morality around the ways we define ourselves in groups, religious affiliations, race, ethnicity, political affiliations. We've talked about all of that this hour. Scientist and author Joshua Green says it's all the same device in our brain working, a social brain machine, he calls it, for manufacturing moral decisions by relying on the behavior of the people around us. Sometimes the tribal machine works well, and other times not so well. Joshua Green is the author of Moral Tribes: Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them.
People's moral attitudes, their judgments, are heavily influenced by the people around them and by the people with whom they identify. And so a tribe, in the broader metaphorical sense that the book draws upon, is a group with a shared moral identity, a shared sense of what's right or what's wrong. And that can be a very small group. It could be a small group of hunter-gatherers living in the Amazon, or it could be a very large group, such as evangelical Christians spread all over the United States or even around the world.
And how do you think humans are wired to group themselves in tribes, or are they?
I think we absolutely are. Young children are very attuned to accents, and children who are about a year old or younger will prefer to accept a gift from someone who speaks with a native accent as opposed to someone who's perfectly comprehensible but speaks with an unfamiliar accent. So we think very naturally in terms of groups, in terms of us versus them.
And really, these are the lessons of coming into the world and being a conscious human being, first learning that me is different from you, and then us is different from them. Do we learn that in a good way, in a straightforward way, or in a way that causes virtually all the problems we have in the world?
I think the answer is both. Morality is really a device for getting individuals to form a group, for getting me to be part of an us, which means being willing to give up something yourself to pay some cost yourself for other people. And that's the core of human morality. It's basic decency. It's altruism. It's caring about other people. But we didn't evolve to be universally cooperative. Anything that evolves biologically has to have some kind of competitive advantage. And there's no competitive advantage to being nice to everybody because you're being nice to everybody. So human morality is really a double-edged sword. It turns me into us, but it turns us against them.
A lot of the great examples in your book come from societies that are facing a set of resources that are limited and a certain amount of adversity. And that seems to produce a level of cooperation. I'm wondering, and it's not universal, of course, but I'm wondering if the planet really does take a huge dive here and humans have to deal with all kinds of limitations, 10 billion people on the planet, deteriorating environment. Is that going to inflame and enforce our moralistic tribal tendencies, or will it revert us to some Hobbesian state of nature where it's everyone for themselves?
Well, I hope it's not the latter, and I'm optimistic that it's not. But I think, you know, what's happened in the modern world is that people who are physically very distant and culturally very distant can have enormous influence. You know, we can bomb people on the other side of the world. We can send life-saving food and medicine to people on the other side of the world. And this is completely absurd, completely unheard of from the perspective of our hunter-gatherer past. And so I think that what's been happening over the last few hundred years and intensely over the last few decades is we're realigning our moral instincts. And I mean instincts broadly, not just in the biological sense, but our gut reactions about how to relate to other people. And I think a lot of what's going on right now in American politics and around the world is a tension between a more global vision of morality, people rallying around abstract ideals that are in some sense not bound to any particular tribe, versus local tribal moralities.
You know, I'd love for you to explain this fast thinking versus slow thinking idea here, because it does seem like one is great if you're a wolf surrounded by enemies, and the other is great if you're, you know, someone on the top of a mountain acting a little bit more like a Buddhist priest.
Right. One way to put the general idea of the book is that there are two different kinds of moral problems, and there are two different kinds of thinking, we call it fast and slow. And progress depends on getting the right kind of thinking lined up with the right kind of problem. So along with David Rand and Martin Novak, we did a set of experiments where we had people play what's called a public goods game, where everybody gets $10, let's say, and they can put their money into a common pool or keep their money. And when the money goes into the common pool, it gets doubled by the experimenter, and then it gets evenly divided among everybody, all four people. So the selfish thing to do is to keep your money. The cooperative thing to do is to put your money in, and that maximizes the amount that gets doubled by the experimenter, and everybody ends up better off. What we found is that if you put people under time pressure, they're more likely to contribute. If you make people stop and think slowly, they're less likely to contribute. And what this suggests is that we have gut reactions that make us cooperative when it's a group of me's trying to form an us. But when it's us versus them, we have very different gut reactions. We have very different gut reactions, as you know, about gay marriage or Obamacare or Israelis versus Palestinians in the Middle East. And so it's those us versus them kinds of problems where our gut reactions get us in trouble and where we need to think a bit more slowly.
So finally, we could really blow it here on planet Earth, but according to your research and according to this book, we are, at least it appears, wired to solve our problems.
Well, we're wired to solve two different kinds of problems. So we're wired to inherit or acquire emotional dispositions that allow us to solve problems that we've already encountered. So, for example, if I showed you a picture of a swastika or a guy in a pointy white hood, a part of your brain called the amygdala will probably send a signal saying, ah, that's something kind of bad, something that requires attention. But it's not because you've had necessarily run-ins with Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan. It's because you've learned that from other people. And likewise, if you're a kid, you know not to touch the hot stove after you've touched it once, right? So your genes and your cultural experience and your personal experience, all that trial and error experience feeds into your emotions. But we have another way of solving problems. And this is really uniquely human, or at least far more developed in humans than in other species, which is the ability to have a general map of the world and solve problems that we've never solved before. So to just take a personal instance of this, if I said to you, John, I'll give you $1 million if you meet me at the post office in Oxford, Maine in exactly 1 week. You've never been there before, but you can figure it out. You can say, okay.
I can figure that out, Joshua.
Right.
Yeah.
Other animals can't do that, right? And that's an example of slow thinking. It's using our uniquely human capacity to sort of represent cause and effect relationships in the world, to take in new information and to put it all together flexibly to come to a plan of action that's going to get us what we want.
Well, Joshua, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And what do you say, Oxford next Tuesday?
All right. Sounds good. See you there.
Joshua Green, author of Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Joshua Green, a member of the Tribe of Harvard Professors, thanks to a tribe called Quest for helping us this hour. Scary Stories, Fear of the Unknown. Listen to this one from Austin, Texas. One of my friends hosted a hayride for a group of us to trick-or-treat through their gated community. They had the security guard tell us and our parents as we entered to be careful because a killer had escaped prison. After the ride, as we were pulling into my friend's driveway, her father came out of the woods chasing us with a chainsaw. We scattered and were scared to death, I'll bet. We'd love your story. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments across the country.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.